Okay, so I sent to go to another critical point before we get into the book. I sent you a recent interview with Derek Kirkhoff, and I wanted to point this out. Let's see, you got question one, question two, question three, and a long answer. And he says, presently, in books that I am writing now, very much under the McLuhan influence and the Figure Ground Probe, I'm working on two great competing, not to say conflicting, grounds of the present human condition. Language, and in brackets, and literacy on one hand, with its principal figure, that is meaning, and, on the other hand, the so-called digital transformation, with algorithms that do not need meaning, that do not need meaning at all to be efficient and now run our lives. That is a really big contrast. And the evidence is the serious epistemological crisis that the spread of quote, fake news, unquote, and science denials the world over is imposing on everybody. We will overcome neither the pandemic nor the threats of climate change before we resolve this crisis of shared meaning across the planet. As you can see, I'm here to save the world. Now, this is an example of Derek's sloppy thinking. Sloppy perception, sloppy expression, which I've criticized him doing since the 80s. McLuhan, this is not McLuhan's method if he's trying to be something like McLuhan. McLuhan would not try to resolve the argument over what's news or fake news or that someone is denying science. He would explain why that became an issue, not over... Uh-oh, us academics are being denied by the hoi polloi who don't know what science is anymore. And they don't know that we are in a serious ecological crisis, you know, which is what happened under Trump. The alt-right did not go along with the idea that there was climate change and something else. And that's the iconic alt-right. Who knows what the alt-right really is? It's millions of people posting.
It's not just the alt-right, it's also the alt-left and the alt-center. There's increasing consciousness in the world that science and insight and academic degrees can be used to exercise power. And people are getting sick of people like de Kirchhoff says here, I'm going to save the world. Just let me run everything, and I'm going to do it because I have superior insight.
Yes.
And people of every political persuasion are calling bullshit on that.
Yeah.
They're saying don't try and leverage how smart you are as signed by you. This here we're back at the counterfeit check, right?
Yes.
To take our money and to run things. That's exactly why the world's in such shit.
I know. And so here's this Chinese guy, you know, impressed with McLuhan and then therefore Derek, because he was at the center and replaced McLuhan, took over. And he's looking for insight about McLuhan, and Derek has a great opportunity to do and say things like you're saying or what I'm saying, but he falls back into his cultural blindness. And do you get my point, though? McLuhan would explain why science denial has become a trend, not we've got to correct science denial. You got to, in other words, McLuhan would define the problem in a different way, which would not allow you to have knee-jerk superiority battles.
Well, I think that's what we just did.
Yes. No, yes. No, I'm saying. So I have only read that far in the interview. But, again, Derek has muddied this situation, and he needs to be corrected. And I probably will excerpt this part, what we just said, and post it on his Facebook page. But, meanwhile, you've read it all, and you said you have some problems with it. Do you want to say... maybe not too much, but anything you want to say, like I just wanted to say. Do you have something in the interview, if you just scan it?
No, I didn't. I read the interview, but I didn't find anything too interesting about it. The only interesting things about it are criticisms that can be made, like the one that you just made. The whole idea of I'm here to save the world, I mean, it's almost laughable that somebody can have that point of view these days. Haven't we had enough people saving the world in the 20th and 21st centuries?
Wow.
Scary stuff.
Right. I just scanned down. He makes a comment on me. Let's look at this. Question 10. Well, you would have read this. You have taught at the Chinese guy says, you have taught at the university, I'm assuming he's Chinese, you have taught at the University of Toronto in Canada and at the Polytechnical Institute of Milan in Italy. How does McLuhan research in Canada and Italy compare with that in the United States? So he says, Derek says, the good news is that after having conspued McLuhan for decades before and after his death, the University in Toronto and Canada in general have come to their senses and begun to see the value of his work. So maybe conspued was, you know, put down McLuhan. The University of Toronto and Canada have seen the value of his work. There is a growing concentration of McLuhan scholars everywhere, but particularly stemming from Toronto with extremely rich Facebook communities that are international. Among others, the highlighting of McLuhan's work has benefited greatly from three firebrands. One from Italy, Paolo Granata, who, one could say, was compelled to emigrate to Toronto from Bologna to get closer to McLuhan's heritage that he promotes with brio. Another, also in Toronto, Alex Kuskas, who tills the McLuhan fire on Facebook with extremely valuable and astute miscellaneous bits of wisdom and anecdotes by and on McLuhan. And Marshall's own grandson, Andrew McLuhan. So that's Paola, Alex, and Andrew. Andrew McLuhan, who carefully reviews his grandfather's works and turns them into public lectures and online courses, followed by a growing community of fans. There are others, of course. For instance, Bob Logan, my old friend and colleague, an unofficial co-founder of the McLuhan Program, in brackets, he didn't actually do that, but thanks to him and Marshall's son, Eric McLuhan, getting together with me at and after Marshall's funeral in January 1981, he died on the last day of 1980. In the last day of 1980, we all three took the decision to continue the Monday night seminars and do everything we could to keep the McLuhan name and the Center for Culture and Technology alive and thriving at the University of Toronto. And that we did, against all odds. And then, then further afield... What's that mean, further afield, like off in left field? and then further afield, in many ways, I must name Bob Dobbs, who, in spite of quirks of his own, and you knew this, you read this, and you didn't tell me, right? Or you missed it. Did you read that?
Well, I don't find any of this sort of stuff very interesting. It doesn't register with me as something that requires comment.
Okay, Bob Dobbs, who, in spite of quirks of his own and a weird commitment to some ghostly online figure called Ion, has amassed a formidable database or database. Do you say data or data? What do you say?
Database.
Has amassed a formidable database on McLuhan, as well as interviewing many scholars and other people friendly to the McLuhan tradition that he makes available as radio shows in quotes, and online too. That's nice that he mentions it, but badly stated, and I am not at all that, and McLuhan and Ian is not an online figure. Anyways, no one's ever going to get that. And Derek's been on the show. I've interviewed, he's dialogued with Ion, and I thought that was great that he did it, and I thought he should have continued, but for some reason he stopped. So... He then says, as far as Italy is
concerned... Why do you think that it's interesting or complimentary or anything else to be mentioned in something like this? I don't get that.
Oh, this is status land. This is academia. And to mention me is illegal. Not allowed to mention me. I've even been deleted from the Figure Ground Journal because academics complained about me. I mean... I think it's very nice that Derek brings me up, and he, his general acknowledgement of what I've done, other than the ION stuff, is accurate. I've done that. As a matter of fact, I could claim that I speared the McLuhan revival in the mid-'80s with Nelson on CKLN. And that led to Mondo 2000 guys picking up on us. Mary met them. And then that led to Wired to counter the Mondo 2000 gang, and they made McLuhan their patron saint. But the Mondo 2000 gang got into McLuhan through me and Nelson. And we were doing it in the period when nobody was interested in McLuhan in the 80s. So that certainly would not be true for academia, but like you say, who the hell are those guys? they didn't do anything. I got the word McLuhan out there for the Generation Xers and younger more than anybody else. Just because I was on college radio. And, many people through the years, have thanked me saying, hey, I never would have heard of McLuhan unless I heard your ridiculous show. Your crazy show. So it's nice of Derek to mention me in an academic setting. So that's okay, but let's see what he says. Since you find the McLuhan industry disgusting, let's see. This is what he's talking about. So he says, as far as Italy is concerned, it has been friendly to McLuhan from the start and has never defamed him as the French did at the beginning, calling him a charlatan, and Guy Debord stating that McLuhan was the most convinced imbecile of his time. And he has the French version, l'imbécile le plus convaincu de son temps. And Debord was saying that just before the fall of the Berlin Wall, an event that McLuhan in many ways would have been able to predict much better than Debord. Then he says, okay, Derek says, okay, peace to the French who have also changed their minds and also learned to respect his legacy. The U.S., on the other hand, either consider McLuhan as an American, and he puts that in quotes, without checking their sources, a way of co-opting famous foreigners who happen to speak English, or they begrudgingly admit that, in spite of being only Canadian, he did make a difference. But their real hero is Neil Postman, who, like many other people across the planet, merely, quote, borrowed McLuhan. But then again, as Picasso is supposed to have said, quote, great artists just steal, the others borrow, end of quote. To be fair, I should add that in New York, around Lance Straight and the media ecology he founded, media ecology quotes, there's a very dynamic McLuhan research group, including Paul Levinson, who wrote several books about Marshall, among which Digital McLuhan and other less-known researchers and students who will eventually emerge. Is that correct? Who wrote several books about McLuhan, among which Digital McLuhan and other lesser-known He wrote books about McLuhan, among which Digital McLuhan, then there should be a comma, and then other lesser-known researchers and students who will eventually emerge, probably under the influence of McLuhan via Carolyn Marvin. The USC Annenberg School for Communication Journalism has added effects, to the list of main topics of research about communication. And finally, let us remember that until a few years ago, Wired magazine featured McLuhan on their masthead as the patron saint. Patron saint is quote. Now, this is Derek being the university president, nodding to all the departments of the industry and acknowledging everybody, whereas he should be critical of every one of them, especially the New York gang, Levinson and those guys. So that's where Derek, I guess you would call that being political, right? He's politically savvy or politically congenial to everybody, so that puts you into the switchboard position. You're the guy that will not shake up other institutions that might be interested in McLuhan. You follow what I'm saying here?
Yeah, I follow, but I'm not sure I buy it. Like you said, I'm disgusted by the McLuhan industry, and disgust is the wrong word. My problem with all of this answer here is that in order to start reading McLuhan, you have to know the sorts of problems he was addressing, and addressing with passion. And the he wasn't addressing the problem of how to get tenure. He wasn't addressing the problem of how to enrich your CV. He wasn't addressing the problem of how to get grants. He wasn't addressing the problem of how to get mentions in secondary literature or online somewhere. He was passionately interested in the downward spiral of the world into potential destruction, and wondering how that could be avoided. And if you don't, start with that problem, and don't get that problem stuck in your craw, then you're not reading McLuhan. You're just mining McLuhan for other purposes.
Yeah. No. Is McLuhan thinking big?
Yeah, but big, not in the sense of the Kirchhoff saying here. You see, I'm trying to save the world and all that. thinking big can mandate thinking very small, and that's because the in trying to navigate a way out of the cul-de-sac, it may be that minute analysis must be made in certain ways. Right? So, for example, modern medicine, McLuhan often said, came from doctors beginning to wash their hands. So there was a dawning of doctors to the fact that there are things that can't be seen that can be deadly. And so you have to try to obviate those things in order to do good and in order to help the patient. And so it's the same thing now. We don't know how to get out of the cul-de-sac. That is the problem of the cul-de-sac. It's being lost. So being lost implicates that we don't know what it would be to think big or to think small. Mm. Those are things that we have to find out. And it's what McLuhan was trying to specify is that in order to think about these things, we have to define matters like media. So he took over the idea from Innes that communication is the key to understanding different cultures. Understand their different modes of communication, you can understand the different cultures. But in order to understand the different communication modes, you have to understand their media. So in Innes, that's like stone engraving or clay or papyrus, etc., up onto radio. McLuhan agrees with all of that. Yes, we need to concentrate on communication. The key to communication is the media of communication. But what are media? And so McLuhan is saying we need to have the microscopic analysis of what media are in order to understand the big questions of communication and culture.
Is philosophy a category for thinking big for a certain phase of the history of media, so that you wouldn't call McLuhan a philosopher today, or do you say the greats who tackled the cul-de-sac were all philosophers? Would you give them that term?
No, they certainly it's not the case that they people who found a way out of the cul-de-sac were all philosophers, right? The main way that people have seen to get out of the cul-de-sac is to relativize it, to see the cul-de-sac as only one mode of human experience. So for you have somebody like Shakespeare, who's a great master of different kinds of human experience, he doesn't have any trouble envisioning people who are locked in the cul-de-sac, but at the same time he envisions people who aren't. And it's that multiple visioning or multiple understanding or multiple hearing of different kinds of experience that we've lost. To be locked into the cul-de-sac means that we do not understand any longer what it would be to relativize it. Mm. If you look at Amazon Prime movies or Netflix movies, it's very clear that we don't have art anymore. Art is gone from the Western experience.
Well, you mean by art, people getting out of the cul-de-sac?
No, I mean, when people think that they're doing art.
Which is a term that refers to an archetypal epiphany or something. Is this, what do you mean?
No, it just means how can I put this? Hegel said that there are three absolute forms of experience: philosophy, religion, and art. And what is an absolute form of experience is to grapple with the larger issues of human life and to articulate them. And so for Hegel, it was unimaginable that a society could not have all three of these things. But he understood that at his time, he died in 1831 or 1832, I forget which, in his time, philosophy was dying. And so he, I believe it's in the Logic, he talks about the incredible fate of a country that no longer has metaphysics. Well, a century after that, there was no longer any religion. And now a century after that, there's no longer any art. But I'm just talking about in Western civilization, because yeah. I don't think it's true in Russia or in China or in small countries in Asia or countries in South America. I think all of these, philosophy, religion, and art, are still alive in various ways.
But what about philosophy? Did that die? Like art and religion?
Yes. And what Hegel saw was that it was already dead in his time.
Right.
But
so
certainly,
he's dealing with the cancellation of philosophy. Then 100 years later, 1900s, the cancellation of religion. And then the beginning of the 21st century is the cancellation of art. That's
right,
the sequence
right.
there.
And the cancellation of philosophy was sort of signed by Nietzsche.
Yeah.
Right. And of course, what he also foresaw was the death of religion.
Yeah.
And I think it could be argued that Nietzsche also saw the death of art.
Yeah. Yeah, you've had spiraling replays and benefits of a little later after Nietzsche repeating the Nietzsche pattern. So that were thinkers later that saw the death of religion, art, and philosophy, but, I don't know, deeper, like maybe Heidegger or somebody, then McLuhan, maybe Warhol. I don't know. We've been running on the same spot since 1850, since we got into the electric age. So let's say that's an electric realization, and Nietzsche was the first.
Well, let's say that I would prefer to say that the electric realization took place mostly in science and culminated in atomic weapons and nuclear weapons. But meanwhile, the wisdom necessary to deal with these advancements in science got derailed, and got derailed in ways that Harold Innes tried to specify in the 19th century, with the takeover of government by media and by bureaucracies and by the economy of weapons. The legacy of the 19th century to the 20th century was that the things that are necessary for human culture had gone into eclipse and have been expressed ever since 1914 until the present day in war.
Mm. Yeah. So we're talking about the McLuhan industry and the failure for most people to probe the cul-de-sac.
Correct.
Who are some of the greats that you think did it over the last 3,000 years?
Well, did it would require some definition, of course, but
yeah.
Let's just say that they...
Well, we've been defining it for 36, 35 episodes.
That's right. We're attempting to do that.
Yeah.
But the sign of a great mind is the ability to understand in fundamentally different ways.
So, in different ways, did you say? In fundamentally different ways?
Yeah, in different ways. Yes. So the only way out of the cul-de-sac is to relativize it, to understand that there are other ways of thinking that aren't caught up in the cul-de-sac. And so already with Plato, for example, you have him thinking about the different springs, the different origins of thought that are already a plural ontologically. So it just, for Plato, it belongs to human beings to be exposed to different ways of thinking. And in order to solve problems, you need to use that facility of human beings to think differently. But in order to understand that facility, you have to understand that there is a metamorphosis, or there is a tactility, or there is a transition possible, a gap between these different ways. Right? If the ways are fundamentally different, then what is between them is deeper than fundament. It falls through fundament. Right? So you have a kind of black hole in between the different ways of experiencing. And for the great minds, those black holes in between are transitive. The gap is something that does not delimit communication, it's something that enables communication. So once we have seen that, then we can define the cul-de-sac as the conviction that the darkness around the cul-de-sac is not transitive. So death.
What does that mean? Not transitive. What does transitive mean?
Yeah, it's not transitive, crossable, metaphoric.
Mm. Can't bridge it.
Right. Transitive means you go across.
Okay.
Right.
Which is the definition of metaphor.
Correct. So when McLuhan talks about the gap all the time, when he talks about metaphor, metamorphosis, or he talks about the importance of Ovid, all of these are ways of pointing to the, or he talks about discontinuity. All of these are ways to pointing to how the cul-de-sac can be relativized. So when that's where he starts his thinking. In order to read McLuhan, you have to come from there. But all of the people in the paragraph that we were just talking about know nothing about that, unfortunately. So that means that the McLuhan industry is not starting to, is not even starting to read McLuhan.
Right. Okay.
Go ahead.
No, you can finish. You can finish that sentence, that part of your sentence.
They're reducing McLuhan to their understanding.
Right.
But the reverse has to happen. What they need to do is open their understanding to him. Right?
Yeah.
But not because McLuhan is some sort of unique guy in the history of the world. That's the same thing they have to do to understand anybody that's great.
Right, and I think you're saying that the great are what Harold Bloom did in his later books. Remember, he wrote about the canon. He defended the canon, the Western canon.
Right.
You would accept the greats that are considered the greats and used to be the core of the curriculum 100 years ago in the arts and sciences and philosophy, right?
Mm-hmm.
The
yes.
greats are the greats. But we have come to an interesting point where the greats are not a service anymore.
Correct. So that's exactly what I was just going to say, is that
good.
the curricula, which emphasize certain greats, kind of broke down, and so what's needed is a reinstitution
of the great process, maybe the process of greatness, or just a restating of the original problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because yes,
sure.
People would go and study the greats and maybe not know what the problem was, just appreciate the creativity of something, the inventiveness, or maybe they saw the problem in abstract, but they were not put in the position of figuring out the problem or encountering the cul-de-sac.
Yeah, well, I would say that the problem of communication, which is not just a question about what is communication, it's also a problem of communicating the problem of communication, right? So you get into a circle here.
Yeah.
The problem of communicating has probably been known forever. It's probably the kind of problem you have between all grandparents and all teenagers.
Mm.
When Plato looked at the problem and tried to imagine how the academy would work, what he apparently thought was that it's not possible through writing to convey this stuff. it's only possible to do it orally. But then once the person has the idea through oral instruction, then they can understand the writing, and you can bring the orality and the literacy together. But that problem that Plato looked at has gone through all of Western tradition and has never properly been solved. And now we've gotten ourselves into a tremendous hole where we have these weapons of destruction, and we don't have the wisdom to know how to deal with them.
Right. And on page 31 of Counterblast, where he talks about how arts and sciences at some point cease to be anti-environmental, that's the process you're talking about. The greats, for media reasons, would become opaque, and they couldn't communicate the problem, but they were actually engaging, but it couldn't be transmitted, so you needed a new art or science or another great to bring people back to the problem or the dilemma and the questions. So today, where McLuhan says we have nothing but an ersatz anti-environment, we don't have an anti-environment. And so McLuhan was realizing, we're not going to find out the problem. We've forgotten the problem, which you were just saying a couple minutes ago. We've forgotten the cul-de-sac issue.
Right. Well, it's there's very little difference between we've forgotten it and we've seen it so much in front of us that it scared the hell out of us, and therefore we're not going to think about it.
Yeah. So, okay, so that's, we understand it fits into what we've been saying for 35 shows. We've elaborated our objection to the schools, the McLuhan industry that Derek is a manager of the image of the school. That's what he's become, in Europe anyways, and some parts of the States. He has been a Smithsonian scholar, I think, one of those institutions of Washington. I don't know of any other McLuhanite who got that that distinction. So he has established a kind of a patina of success in keeping the McLuhan mantle going. But we who take on the cul-de-sac find that that's a misinterpretation of Derek's project. But what do you expect? Nobody knows what the project is anymore.
Right. But I don't want to... McLuhan school is not wrong in thinking that there is stuff worth preserving in McLuhan.
Right.
So it's not as if these people have just completely misspent their lives and are useless. It's that they have been of great service in one way, but tragically, they, at the very time that they have helped to preserve the legacy, they have obscured it.
Yeah.
And that's a very common thing in the history of Western civilization.
Right. So Barry Nevitt used to talk about the archivist, and the archivist is comprehensive. The World Wide Web, Internet, social media world has turned many people into archivists. And so a lot of academia is people scrabbling back to find some obscure somebody that was forgotten and, hook them up and add them to the archive. So that, since our electric knowledge environments are naturally archiving everything, we are imitating that, becoming personal archivists in finding a role in the world of the Android meme. So that's what's the problem. Well, that's another way of talking about the problem, is we have been reduced to archiving. And Coker talks about this in some of his books, the archiving mania. So that shows.
Notice it's the same. It's the same problem that we are talking about with art, and that is the archivist finds something to archive, and with the tools of the internet and the increasing digitalization of everything, people can be quite successful at archiving. But if you then ask, who decided that this figure was important, number one, and number two, who decided that these things that have been archived are important to that important figure? And the answer to that is, the archivist decided that. Right? And so then you say, where did the archivist get that power? Well, the archivist decided that. And, yeah, and it just sort of falls through itself. So the whole problem with the archival project, if you will, or even with the McLuhan project, is that it tends to obscure the very problem at hand, which is where do we get the reality? Is the problem posed by the cul-de-sac? Where does the reality come from?
You mean where is reality, which is the cul-de-sac problem?
Well, if the artist signs the reality of the artwork, if the archivist signs the reality of the importance of the figure that's being archived, and if the archivist signs the particular things that are being archived as important to the important figure that is the subject of the archive, all of these signatures presuppose a certain reality. And so as soon as we ask, where does that reality come from, we're in the cul-de-sac, because no one knows where that reality comes from.
Yes, and you know what? You've walked us right into the realization of the archivist and all the aspects of being the archivist, selecting and arbitrarily or willy-nilly creating value somewhere. That's the tech body. That is the tech body. A big part of what the tech body is. It messes with the archive and also is the archivist of us, of all the details of us, of the surveillance situation. But it's more playfully involved than people realize. So thank you for getting us to our topic. I think the tech body is the archive incarnate.
Okay, good. So I want to hear more about this. In particular, I'd like to know how this differs from the Android meme.
Yeah.
And kind of power the tech body has as an archival power.
Great.
Right? What is its shapes and what is its manifestations?
Yeah, I think we actually got to a way of talking about the tech body with this archive meme. So let me bring up the essay. We were at page 39, and we were talking about the indecipherable nebula. You remember that? Look at your copy, page 39. And we finished that, my discussion of Baudrillard. In the last paragraph it says, which is in the middle of 39,